Welcome, everybody, to this edition of Liberty Lens. I am your host, Big John, joined today, as always, by my capable and handsome co-host, Mr. Mike Termott. Mike, how are you doing today?
It's good to be with you, John. You always oversell on some level. I appreciate that, and I resent it simultaneously. Thanks for covering today's topic. It's a tricky one, and I believe that it'll be the first of several. And I know you and I have spoken. We're going to try not to cover 5,000 years of history here because there's so much to talk about that's relevant right now.
Right. And for those of you that may have guessed by Mike's opening comments, we're going to talk about the humanitarian crisis in Gaza today. Now, this is a very hot, both topical issue and, as Mike said, one steeped in history. How did we get here? Why does there always seem to be conflict in that part of the world? Why is it seem like there's always a war going on, Mike, and there's always human suffering taking place in that area? So I'm going to kick it over to you because you are much more knowledgeable than I am in these areas, in this particular issue especially, along with just about everything else. So let's start out with this, Mike. Give me the pertinent backstory, especially for our younger viewers.
Sure.
How did we get to where we are today, roughly? How did we get to the point where there's this constant state of tension and conflict between Israel and its neighbors, the surrounding neighbors?
I think there's a lot of answers to that, and everyone ought to be warned, you know, if you ask seven people, you're probably going to get seven different answers. One of the obligations of your program here, John, our program, is that we give a little bit of a libertarian perspective. And so what I'm going to lean into is the idea that when one nation or people or race, one group dominates another, you're inherently going to have problems.
Right.
And I know a lot of people think, oh, you know, you're immediately blaming Israel. No, that's not what I mean. What I mean is the Ottoman Empire dominated this area for the better part of four centuries, let that sink in, and tamped down what were deep internal conflicts, unresolved. Now, one might argue that, you know, if not everyone killed everyone else over 400 years, you must have been doing something right. And there is a counter argument that says the Ottoman Empire at least, you know, kept a lid on things for a while. But this is an area, present-day Israel, the Palestinian territories, the Middle East in general. This is an area in which people have had long-standing conflicts, and because of the empire and a number of other reasons, there weren't nations carved out that did a very good job of reflecting how people felt about their particular, you know, brethren, their, you know, how we feel about national culture just was not borne out. So, you know, in World War I, the Ottoman Empire receded, the British took over, the British controlled this area for 30 years, also had a struggle to keep a lid on conflict. And whenever there's a change, one of the reasons why dominance from one group over another, especially from an outside party, an outside power, like in the case of the Ottomans, and certainly in the case of the British, one of the problems is that that eventually is going to go away. And when it goes away, things explode. The United States learned this when trying to dominate Afghanistan and Iraq, right? You take away whatever authority is there, yada, yada, yada. We know how this plays out because we watched it, you know, literally 50 times in the last century. So the Brits eventually wring their hands of this area for a variety of reasons, not the least of which the expense of controlling an empire becomes excessive when a piece of that is just preventing conflict on a daily basis among folks that hate each other's guts.
Right.
So the British eventually figure out we're better off giving it up. They hand it over to the United Nations. The United Nations develops the, and importantly, we need to remember the United Nations is not an entity unto itself, except on paper and in the minds of a lot of liberals. We're talking about a lot of national governments who came together, came up with the idea that we're going to partition the bulk of this area into Israel and Palestine, and these are going to be two different, in the long run, wait for the word, states.
Right.
Okay. A lot of folks weren't having this idea. And it, you know, the idea was hatched in the 20s and developed in the 30s. Of course, what happened to the Jewish population in Europe during World War II was a major motivator for a lot of Europeans to carve out an Israeli state, a homeland for the Jews.
Right.
And, you know, one of the things that you and I were just talking about a few minutes ago before the show is one of the inherent conflicts is in perception of
right.
the entire world, right? A lot of people look at Israel as a 5,000-year-old state, nation, people, and as a political, modern-day defined political structure, it's a nation that is less than 75 years old. That's the first conflict.
Right.
So, 1947, the plan is supposed to go into effect in, well, is ratified in 48. It's supposed to go into effect. I hope I have my dates at least approximately, right?
Yep, 48.
And immediately, right out of the box, like within hours, Arab nations are invading some of these territories ostensibly to protect them and at the same time simultaneously protect these territories not only from the Israelis, from the Europeans, and from each other. You know, the Egyptians and the Jordanians do not want the other gaining too much control over these
right.
areas. And the Egyptians take over what we started referring to as the Gaza Strip, when the Jordanians had taken over what we quickly began referring to as the West Bank, meaning the left-hand side of the Jordan River. So the Egyptians dominated the Gaza area for 20 years until 1967 when war broke out again. I say broke out when the Arabs went after the Israelis. War broke out again. During those 20 years, 19 or 20 years, the Egyptians controlled the Gaza Strip without annexing it. Mm. And I think that this is an important backstory element for all of our youngsters out there who would like to knee-jerk blame Israel for, and I'm not going to defend Israel, but who, not going to blame them knee-jerk either. You know, it is not the case that Israel is the first nation to occupy the Gaza Strip without fostering the development of a second state. Egypt controlled this area, refused to annex them, did not give them Egyptian citizenship, just sat on them. It languished as an underdeveloped area without sufficient human rights, without sufficient autonomy, a little bit of, you know, self-control. The Palestinian Authority comes in. The Palestinian, we all remember Yasser Arafat.
Right.
Youngsters, go ask your folks. The Palestinian Authority is a political wing of a group that was born out of terrorism.
PLO, right?
The PLO, because they were trying to get rid of Israeli occupation. But remember, importantly, this is an occupation that began with the Egyptians. Okay, so none of that makes any of the other pieces okay, right?
By the way, folks, this is not Mike hedging. This is what happens when you talk about the history of the Middle East and Gaza. There's a lot of, having said that, comma, but, right?
There's
a lot of that, okay? So Mike's not trying to be wishy-washy on you folks. There really is no other way to phrase it, right?
No, as a matter of fact, the right way to describe this, I don't think, is wishy-washy, but one group was a real jerk, and then the other group was a real jerk.
Right,
I mean,
right.
None of this excuses the bad behavior of the next group.
Correct.
It does, exactly. However, give you some context because, you know, as Ronald Reagan used to say, one group's, you know, freedom fighters is another group's terrorists, right?
Correct.
The Egyptians, I think, made a case that their invasion in 1948 was to protect these people. But at the same time, they had huge political motivations, and the Israelis, the same thing. It's not unreasonable that the Israeli government felt like the best way to protect their population was to take over this territory back in 67. That was a very reason, not to say the only course of action available to them. I'm not trying to give them a complete pass here, but it was not completely unreasonable given the security threats. The Gaza Strip was dominated for many years. We eventually flipped into more of a blockade than an occupation. There are those who would argue with the definitions of those terms. But bottom line, the Gaza Strip is an area that now has over 2 million people. The population has actually been declining during this recent war for tragic reasons. People who have not had a history of self-governance, whose last election was, what, 06? Do I have that right?
It might be. Yeah, it might be that long.
Approximately
06, 05, yeah.
Right. Hamas thumped out its competitors, including with violence, not just at the ballot box, and for a variety of reasons, including bad behavior on part of Hamas, arguably bad behavior on part of the Israelis, there has not been an election since then. I don't think there is anyone who would claim that Hamas is a legitimate government authority. That would be absolutely silly. And it would also be silly, again, not wishy-washy, just bad behavior on multiple sides. It would also be silly to say that Hamas has no support among its population, right? Because it does. The population of Gaza is deeply and understandably resentful of the Israeli occupation, the Israeli blockade, their underdeveloped status.
Right.
Both economically and socially and in terms of self-governance, there's a tremendous amount to resent. And Hamas represents a political force as well as a terrorist organization that has received literally billions of dollars from Tehran over the decades and does so in a fashion that many folks who live in Gaza appreciate, even if if you're a Gazan citizen, I think that you're probably saying in many cases something like, yeah, those guys from Hamas are assholes, but they're our assholes, right?
Right, and I think that's in the overall how people view Hamas's relationship to the Gazan citizens, if we can frame it that way, I think that's another key point, right? Like, are we even certain that Hamas – As a largely terrorist organization, how much do they actually care about their own people? How much do they represent their welfare? Because just to I'm approaching it like from someone who just turns on the news or listens to Dave Smith rant for 5 minutes about this topic, which he seems to do on a daily basis. For example, does Hamas the claim? Probably true, that they're using Gazan citizens, hospitals, mosques, churches as shields.
Absolutely
to protect,
true.
To protect
yeah.
themselves against Israeli
yep.
military action. You come up with that point. Like, if they cared about their own people, they wouldn't use them as shields.
Yep.
And if the Israelis cared about setting up a peaceful solution, they wouldn't be taking out their aggression of, against Hamas on the Gazan citizens.
Yeah,
it's a catch-22 when you start to try to logically sort out, perhaps, as you said, not being wishy-washy, but at what point do you stop pointing at each other and say, stop, right? Because I think that's, at the end of the day, that's one of the things you have to ask yourself, right? Like, who is precipitating the continued suffering of the Gazan people?
I think Hamas and the Israeli government I want to draw a distinction between these groups and their underlying populations.
Sure.
I think that Hamas and the Israeli government both are using the Gazan citizenry for its own purpose. I don't think either one of those two groups, either the Israeli government or Hamas, cares that deeply about the Palestinian population, the Gazan population. And I think it's a very difficult thing for outsiders to comprehend. You know, we impose our life experiences, how it is that we have established our own ethical framework, what it is that we're comfortable thinking about and the comfortable ways in which we're used to thinking about things. We take all of that as Americans, others of us as Europeans or wherever we're from around the world, and we impose this on a situation with 5,000 years of history of conflict. And so it inherently brings up a couple of problems. One is, as you point out, Hamas probably really doesn't care about its population very much.
Right.
And I would say the same thing about the Israeli government. On the other hand, number two, they care in a different way than we do. In other words, if I were to say to you, this is going to be a weird example, I'm just making this up on the fly, right? But if I were to say to you, you ought to be willing to give your life for the cause. And then I decide, I feel so strongly about that, I am so sure of myself, John, that you should give your life for the cause, that I'm going to hand up your life for the cause.
Right.
That's a different animal that I think most Americans and most Europeans are not comfortable with, not necessarily because we're ethically different as a species or as a race, but because this is not our lived experience.
Right.
There have been times when we have been asked, as libertarians, I think that most people from time to time, they get asked about things that they care about deeply. I was asked last year, regarding the Chase Oliver statement, what would you do if a gun were to your head and you had to choose between the Republicans and the Democrats? And he said the gun would go off, and that became viewed by something like 50 million people around the world. And I was asked about that, and I said what I thought was the truth. I think that Chase probably meant it. The reason it came out so quickly is because he did mean it, and I said I think that it's a cute thing to say. You know, the reason it got so much traction, it was cute, it was pithy, whatever, blah, blah, blah. But I think there's something underlying here that we should not simply overlook. I think that most of us as libertarians recognize that our world is going in a very bad direction. Now, would you give your life if it were to, in a significant way, I don't know what that might mean, but make a difference to the world in terms of course correcting our politics? I think that most of us would say yes, absolutely. You know, especially, you know, maybe as a youngster, that should be a difficult thing. But if you're 64 years old and, you know, you've already raised your kids and you've lived your life, if you ask me, would you give your life for the cause? Well, of course, right? If it meant, you know, making America a better place. You know, that's not a question that as a practical matter can come up. And so it's just a weird ethical proposition. Right. But for those living in the Middle East, life and death is something that is much more tangible.
Right.
These are people who have lost friends and family members at extremely young ages for thousands of years. And they perceive these losses. I don't mean incorrectly all the time, right? But they perceive these losses in many cases to be tied to the conflict.
Right.
Okay, so now, would you give your life for the cause? I think that most folks living in this area would say absolutely. Okay. Right. Do you think that your friends and family should? You see where I'm going?
Right.
Yes, right. Absolutely. What about neighbors that you don't know very well? By the dozens, by the hundreds, by the thousands, would you give up 30,000 lives, 60,000 lives in Gaza among a population of only 2 million people? Would you make that sacrifice if you thought it were for the cause? And I think a lot of folks in this region of the world say, absolutely. I'm not suggesting that that is, by our standards, an ethical proposition. It makes me quite nearly want to throw up. I mean, it's literally nauseating, right?
Right.
But you need to have the appropriate context to evaluate what it is that's being discussed here. And if you understand that, I think you get a little bit of insight as to why this problem is relatively intractable. When we talk about, well, you know, putting sanctions on, this is something that you and I have complained about a dozen times. You put sanctions on Vladimir Putin and other wealthy individuals in Russia in order to pressure them into behaving better in places like Ukraine. Oh, it doesn't work very well. No kidding. Right. No kidding. What do they care? Right.
Right.
You know, they don't care about what's going on in Ukraine. If you can make those sanctions stick to those individuals, you might get some traction. But if it's just sanctions that are going to hurt the overall Russian economy, please, that is not something that's going to get a lot of leverage among people that do not face elections.
Also, to get like even simpler, it's like if you view human life as cheap, it just becomes another tool for you to use. And if, you know, one side says, well, it's a good thing to sacrifice your life for the cause. And the other side is like, well, if they're willing to sacrifice their lives, the old George Patton thing, you don't win wars by dying for your country. You win wars by getting the other bastards to die for their country, right?
Right.
So now when you've got both those in conflict with each other, one side willing to die for the cause, the other side willing to accommodate you for the cause, you end up with what we have in Gaza right now, which is a humanitarian crisis, Mike, right? There's people starving to death. As you mentioned, the population has seriously declined in Gaza. People are being displaced. People are being thrown out of what's left of their homes. Even when the rest of the world tries to get some aid through to Gazan citizens, we run into blockades, we run into checkpoints, we run into, obstruction. All for some sort of cause, right? Whether it's the security of Israel, whether it's to use it as a military tactic, whether it's to use it as political pressure. So, Mike, talk to me, first of all, because I know you sent me something like 30 pages worth of notes. You did a very thorough job. Describe to me the nature and scope of the humanitarian crisis in Gaza right now. Forget the political, forget the military.
Yeah. Let's get practical.
Yeah.
Because that is, you know, as Americans, in no small part, this is how we tend to look at things, especially if you're interested in the relatively short run, which is to say, you know, over the weeks and months and a couple of years. Something like between 40% of the population has been displaced, up to possibly as much as 60%, depending on your definition of displacement and who you're asking. In a population that used to be around 2 million, maybe it's 1.9, maybe it's 1.8. At this point, we're talking about 800,000 people being displaced, possibly over a million, and displaced from the north to the south in a relatively small area. And this gets to why it's difficult to define displacement.
Right.
Not only do you have the displacement of people from the north, but in the south, you've therefore got a doubled up population. So the infrastructure has completely collapsed. Economic infrastructure has completely collapsed, both in terms of overall everyday commerce and, more importantly, underlying infrastructure related to agriculture and the development of food.
Right.
So the agricultural sector, which had never been in terrific shape, by the way, which had always been importing food, is virtually worthless at this point. There are those who say that most of the food required to keep the population alive has to be brought in from the outside. That is a tremendous factoid. For 2 million people. You're talking about millions of meals per week to keep the population going. We have seen a lot of violence around the distribution of food. Starting months ago, we saw trucks, not by the dozens, but by the hundreds, not per week, but per day, being brought in. To the credit of the Israeli government, by the way, seeing this many trucks being brought in. As all of your viewers know, the Israeli government controls the entire blockade, the entire border of the Gazan territory, except for the south, where Egypt controls it. There are two, maybe four, depending on your definition, of major portals to get in. And then in the south, Egypt controls an extremely important portal, which is now closed to the Gazan area. So you've got hundreds of trucks. The United Nations and many other agencies in the business of providing food have been fully engaged for months. They try to keep data on this. They try to make reports on this. They have faced tremendous challenges, a lot imposed by the Israeli government, a lot imposed by Hamas, and I might argue that most of it being imposed by the conflict between the two. In other words, Hamas likes to do two things that drive everybody crazy. They like to take the food on the way in and distribute themselves. That gives them political leverage, allows them to take advantage, take credit.
Right.
It also allows them to give the food to their fighters first. So, you know, if you're a fighter, you might be getting three squares and everyone else is getting a half a square per day. That's probably okay with a lot of Hamas leaders. The other thing that Hamas has done, and this is all documented, this isn't, you know, me making it up. Right. Hamas has used these truck caravans to two-time the purpose, right? To bring in weapons, materials that can be used to develop weapons, to maintain the tunnel structure, which is extremely expensive any way you want to evaluate that. So there are supplies coming in that the Israeli government, I believe correctly, argues is propping up Hamas's ability to prolong the war. That's number one. Number two, the Israeli government is doing a lot to keep Hamas from gaining control over the food. Well, that's a problem because Hamas doesn't want anyone else controlling the distribution, right? So the Israelis, in many cases, Israeli leaders on the ground have said, these trucks in this particular place aren't moving unless we can be assured that Hamas won't be able to get to it, and unless the agency doing the distribution pledges they're not going to let Hamas be involved. Well, that's a pretty high hurdle to clear. In some cases, right, that's tantamount to saying the trucks aren't going to roll. This is the problem. Now, are there political leaders and military leaders on the Israeli side who believe it's a good idea to use the food, I should say the forbearance of the food, as a political lever to try to squeeze Hamas into releasing hostages and standing down from the war? Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. And that is something that the rest of the world is calling illegal and a lot of Americans and Europeans are calling unconscionable. And that goes back to, you know, one man's conscience is another man's revolution, right?
Right.
So this is a very difficult situation. I think there are a lot of people on the Israeli side who would say war sucks. And that's a very difficult argument to overcome. If you believe that this is nothing but a war and two sides are at war, and therefore anything goes, you see where that argument is going. It's
right.
An argument that Americans have wrestled with since the dropping of the Hiroshima bomb, right, and the Nagasaki bomb. It's what is the alternative? Are we at war or are we not at war? And what role should the aggressor play in keeping a population safe? I think we would all like to believe that the Israeli government is doing everything that it can to prevent famine, starvation, death, injury to the civilian population of Gaza. And at the same time, I think that we have to recognize that that's just not the case, that the prosecution of war in an urban area is inherently difficult and dangerous, no question about it. But that does not argue, and therefore that just is too bad. It argues that you're going to have to make it slower, more expensive, and in some cases compromise certain, this is my view, I'm imposing my own ethics, but right. I think the implication is that that argues that it's going to have to be more slow, more expensive, less efficient in terms of achieving your military objectives, because Hamas has, in a horrifically unethical move, decided to use the civilian population as weapon, as shields, right, from Israeli weaponry. And while we can all call that unethical, we can call it illegal by international standards, I would agree with that. Again, that's imposing an outside set of ethics. It is a set of ethics with which I would agree. I find it virtually unconscionable, but that is what has set up this conflict and this horrific death count, which by the measurement of one side of the conflict is around 30,000 and the other side around 60,000. It's a huge, huge number of people to have been lost, not to mention, you know, devastation of, you know, half of the infrastructure of the northern half of the Gaza Strip.
Right.
And all for what? Americans are, you know, now unfortunately familiar with asking the question, for example, at the end of Afghanistan, at the end of the Iraqi controlled period for 20 years by the U.S. military, at the end of those, Americans are used to asking the question, for what?
Yeah. What did we get done? What did we accomplish?
What did we get done? You know, it's one thing to say, you know, we fought this war, we lost these lives, it costs us this much money, and we achieved something really important. It's another thing, I think, at least from the American standpoint, to say all that, but we didn't. And I believe that the Israeli population is coming to grips with that familiarity as we speak, that the reason the strategies, and not merely the tactics, but the strategies of the Israeli government are coming under question by the Israeli population increasingly, is because they do not see political objectives in the long run being achieved that they view to be important.
And I guess that's where I was going to take this next, which is the end goal. What is the end goal? Because if you're on the Palestinian side of the fence, the end goal is we don't want Israel here. I doubt its coexistence at this point, right?
Right.
And on the Israeli side, especially when you talk to the hardliners, the right-wingers in Netanyahu's government, they're like, we should just annex it. It should become part of Israel. I don't know why we're messing around with this. And from as you just stated, from a strategic, tactical, it makes more sense, and perhaps even in the long run, more humane, if that makes sense, to just say we're taking it over. Right, we're going to take it over and annex the Gaza Strip. Right, from a tactical perspective, that might be more humane than what you're seeing now, which is the starvation of the population for various reasons. To your point, not that you could say one side or the other is 100% to blame for this. So what becomes? And I know no one on this show is going to solve it, Mike. But potentially, what becomes the solution? Like, for example, do we let things play out organically, for lack of a better term, but with the caveat that the U.S. is not going to step in and say, hey, we're going to be the policeman here. We're going to oversee something. We're not going to support Israel. We're not going to support the Gazans. We stay out of it. Let you know, we'll maybe negotiate with Putin. He stays out of it. And let the chips fall where they may, and then we deal with whatever's left. Like, is that a reasonable approach? Because otherwise, Mike, unless you, in my opinion, you take that stance, Now you're on the hook for why are people starving in Gaza? Why is a nation that President Trump very clearly is allied with, Israel, very clearly, where's his influence? I always hear him say, I wish people would stop dying. I give him credit that maybe that's what he truly wants. Why isn't he doing something about it then?
I think everybody wants that. You know, you used a really interesting term, organic, because the time for organic solutions expired, 450 years ago. And since then, everyone has been saying,
yes,
well, given the situation we're in.
Right.
Instead, you know, meaning we wish that there had been an organic solution. We wish that people had stood down in the previous generation, but people didn't. People got involved. Now it's more complicated. Now there's more money, more weapons, more international influence. So now, given the situation that we're in, now we have to be involved. Now we have to play a greater role. At no point has anyone, except arguably for the British in 47, no one has said, we're out.
We're done.
We're done. You know, that's not the way this works. Everybody wants to get in, either because they want influence, they want their military industrial complex to make more money, their domestic population wants it, or because they want influence over the region. These are the various forces, the various reasons. Nobody wants to just leave it alone and walk away. And everyone can now use the excuse that if we walked away, that wouldn't be an organic solution because everyone's already come in. You know, now that so-and-so's come in, now that we have to come in, you know, the Iranians are in, now that we have to be in, the Russians are in, so we have to be in. To the Saudis' credit, you know, we're out. You know, you people have screwed this up so badly. This, you know, you brought up President Trump. It makes his decision to bomb Iran look really smart right now. I know I at the time I pointed out all the risks that were involved, which do not appear yet to be coming to fruition. Let's hope that that's the case, by the way.
Right.
So he's looking really smart at that point. However, when he said, hey, how about a long-term solution? We move everyone outside of Gaza and then we redevelop it. That's incredibly naive. You're not relocating 2 million people. There's no one. The Egyptians don't want them. The Israelis don't want them. The Jordanians don't want them. The Syrians can't. The Lebanese can't.
The U.S. certainly isn't opening its doors to immigrants and refugees right now. So we can't take them.
No, it's absolutely not happening. Not 2 million people. Not 200,000 people. It's just not completely sophomoric and a super unfortunate statement. Interestingly, you saw Netanyahu almost literally giggling at that press conference when Trump made that proposal, when he made that proposal, because Netanyahu knows that his right wing of his domestic politics loves the idea of Israel controlling, or at the very least, outside European forces controlling the Gaza Strip and to move the Palestinian, the Arabic population out of it. He's got a whole lot of people who love solutions that go into that into that bucket. This cannot be the case. And that brings us to it is amazing, John, how many layers of this are important. So we'll try to pick up the pace here just a little bit real quick. Look, the Netanyahu government, Netanyahu 3 decades ago was all about, you know, okay, maybe we can do a two-state solution, you know, self-governance, blah, blah, blah. But this, but this, but this, but this, it would be really hard, but we could imagine getting it. Now he's not having it, right? The position of the Israeli government is, by and large, no, we're not having a two-state solution. Okay. That brings us to what does the Israeli government really want here? To your point, what does the end game look like? And I don't get the impression that the Israeli government has developed any endgame solution that makes any sense to anybody other than those trying to keep Netanyahu in a position to win the next election, or at least to write his autobiography that someone will buy. Those right. seem like the only motivations that are they're going on right now. No one has an inkling of what to say in public, at least, about how to bring this to a long-term resolution. It's all about, this is all Hamas's fault. If they would just stand down, turn over the hostages, we could have this resolved by Friday at 2. That's probably true, right?
Yeah.
And I'm sure that Hamas representatives in those same meetings are saying something equally sophomoric, like, if the Israelis would quit the aggression, quit the blockade, quit the occupation, give us the ability to pursue a two-state solution, pursue the idea of self-governance, if the Israelis would agree to all that, we would give them the damn hostages, right? Just complete sophomoric narratives on both sides that don't make any sense in the real negotiation that must take place. When Trump says something like that, one might hope that the Israeli government would jump in and say, no, that's not what where we're going here. We're not about evacuating everybody and take. No, they didn't say that.
Right.
They just let that play out as though, you know, maybe we didn't say it, but that's not the world's worst idea, was the implication.
Right.
I don't think that there is a long-term solution here other than what it is that the Israelis just don't want, which is a self-governing state among the Palestinian territories, however that border gets defined. And I think that the Israelis have, when we look back on this generations from now, 100 years from now, I think that we will look back on this moment representing a strong hand on the part of the Israelis that was overplayed. 2 years ago, has it really been that long?
Yeah, I struggled with that. It's been 2 years. Yeah, you're right. Almost 2 years, yeah.
When October 7 attacks took place, one of the most horrific, darkest days in history, a horrific series of attacks, there is no context, ethically speaking, in which anything that happened that day should be deemed acceptable to anybody, anywhere.
Right.
Starting the next day, the Israeli government had a strong hand in retaliation. The world was united behind the idea that the Israeli government not only had a right to self-defense, but an obligation to self-defense. And I think that they overplayed their hand. I don't say that as an ethical proposition, although that argument can be made. I mean as a practical one, and I offer as evidence the fact that so many nations are now running against the war that were not a year ago, right? Now, you might expect the United Nations has, you know, long been against Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories, blah, 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 whatever.
Right.
Three-quarters of the world's nations are condemning Israel and want a two-state solution in Palestine. That, you know, okay, we get that backdrop. But right. What is different is the French recently said that they're planning on recognizing a Palestinian state in September. The UK government, as soon as Trump leaves London, Scotland, sorry. Yeah. As soon as Trump leaves his golf course, the UK government basically says if certain conditions are met. Now, one might argue those conditions are way too high, never going to happen. But the fact that they said out loud that they would support the right. idea of a self-governing state there is a big deal because not only because that itself is a big deal, but because Trump hasn't said it.
Right.
When's the last time the United Kingdom was out ahead of the United States and in conflict with the United States official position on something so important as war and peace in the Middle East. I find that extremely profound. The Canadians also, the Australians also, you know, the Irish, the Spanish, they've been saying things for years. That's not nearly as important. I don't mean it's unimportant, but not nearly as important. And then the Trump administration comes back with the Canadians are out ahead of us. That's going to make it hard for us to reach a trade agreement. In other words, the Canadians are willing to risk an economic agreement with Washington. So strongly do they feel about what's going on in the Gaza Strip. This is very, very unusual.
Yeah, and I was going to mention that as the closer, Mike, perhaps, is that politically here in the U.S., whereas 10, 20 years ago, I think you would find that if you took an opinion poll, most of the folks in the U.S. would be pro-Israel in the conflict, very supportive of Israel as our traditional ally, quote-unquote, in the Middle East, the only functioning democracy, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I would venture a guess that the numbers are nowhere near what they were 10 years ago for the support of Israel. As a matter of fact, I think President Trump's base, there's a significant chunk of President Trump's base that is disappointed in his outright, blatant 100% support for Israel. Many of them, aside from the people who enjoy trolling, we're also taken aback by that statement, you know, when they start putting out these memes of President Trump in a hard hat, leveling Gaza and all that, you know, which, you know, the White House account is now a troll account, apparently. But, and even recently announcing that any state, any governor, any state government in the U.S. that decides not to conduct trade with Israel will be subject to having its FEMA funding pulled. Now President Trump literally, I hate to say it, politically I'm saying, appears to be in the bag of Israel. In the bag for Israel, rather, I should say. Because that is the perception right now. Like, and again, it goes beyond the traditional U.S. support for Israel because you're seeing, as you mentioned, a lot of cases around the world where even if there's conditions attached to it, we're willing to look for a solution. We want to put an end to the starvation. We want to take some tangible steps towards that, whether it works or not. And how do you feel that President Trump is a populist? We've said that all along. Do you feel that there will be a groundswell in the U.S. among the people that might force President Trump to look at the poll numbers and say, you know what, I need to change my mind here because I'm dipping below 50% or whatever yes. His Mendoza line is.
Yes. I believe that is so. Starting with the October attacks, what I and a lot of other people said was that Israel was running, the Israeli government was running a risk of playing into the hands of Hamas,
right,
which was goading the government into a fight. Yes. Given that Hamas didn't care that much about its population, wanted a fight, wanted to war, wanted as large a conflict as possible, wanted to bring in outside forces, was probably doing the bidding of the Iranians, or at the very least with Iranian tacit approval and probably explicit approval and probably financing. Hamas wanted all these things. They got what they wanted. And Israel's played into their hands. They got sucked in. Politically speaking, I believe that they got suckered in. And I'm afraid that the Trump administration is running the risk of being suckered in the same way. The number of nations around the world that is against the idea of a two-state solution is becoming smaller and smaller and smaller. And eventually it's going to be the United States and Israel, and that's it. That is not completely unimportant. But to your point, the Mendoza line of popularity, what would it take to turn the administration around? My guess is that this is not linear in the sense that things get a little worse in the Middle East and a little bit more of the U.S. population is against the conflict and then things get a little bit worse, and then the United States population is a little bit more against the conflict. I don't think that this is how this works. To your earlier point, the vast majority of people around the world, and in the United States probably especially, don't pay that much attention to the details of international conflict, certainly to the long-term historical bases, right? And I don't think that most people should be obliged to do so. You know, you're running your life, you're pursuing your job, your career, you're raising your family. Carving out enough space to solve Middle East peace is a bit much to ask for most, you know. If you're a young couple in Topeka trying to make ends meet with two jobs and three kids, solving Netanyahu's problems for him is just a bridge too far. Okay.
Right.
So I think there's a big non-linearity coming, which is to say Americans don't pay attention until they do.
Mm.
And what makes Americans pay attention? Well, the ASPCA knows, you know, when they run those pictures of animals in trouble, people send money. Now we're seeing something 100 times worse. We are seeing children literally starve to death.
Right.
The backdrop of violence at the border, violence with the food caravan, doesn't really matter that much. The backdrop of the historical bases of the conflict, the mismanagement by Hamas, the mismanagement by the Israeli government, doesn't matter so much. But when you see people on television dying, when you see children dying, it gets people's attention. Now, the next nonlinearity is the extent to which that happens. Because remember, when you see a handful of children dying, that's the tip of the iceberg. What it means is, you know, for every kid dying from starvation, malnutrition, you've got 100 that are on the edge. And you've got 10,000 that are not getting nearly enough calories on a daily basis, right? It's just the tip of a giant flat iceberg.
Right.
When that rises out of the water, that number does not go 10, 20, 30. It goes 10, 100, 1,000, 10,000, 100,000.
Very geometrical at that point.
It goes very geometrical. And the problem is that all of a sudden Americans not only will have something to which to pay attention, but possibly a lot to which to pay attention. And that will get the attention of the White House, as well as other governments around the world. And if the Trump administration wants to be on the right side of this in terms of our allies around the world, which is probably less important, but wants to be on the right side of the American population, which is more important, they're going to have to realize that it's not just the American population, but disproportionately the MAGA base that is not having the idea that Israel should be allowed to do whatever it wants, that the Israeli government can do no wrong. That's not where the MAGA base has been, and it's certainly not where it's going. So in answer to your question, do I see a turnaround in the administration? Absolutely. And Netanyahu will have no one to blame but himself for overplaying his hand.
Well, I hope that's the case, in the sense that if that's what it takes to get some movement to alleviate the human suffering in Gaza, then let's bring it on, because that, it may be that that's the only thing outside of an all-out annexation, and that might be the only other somewhat peaceful solution, at least to get it rolling. All right, everyone. This has been one of those episodes, not full of glib talk, Mike, but important talk, something that needed to be covered. I'm glad you were here to help me at least make sense of it, hopefully our viewers as well. All right. Join us again next week here on Liberty Lenses. We tackle, again, one issue of importance, try to focus in on it, right here at Grumblings Media, grumblingsmedia.com. Go to all your favorite platforms. Search for the handle at Grumblings Media, Rumble, YouTube, Facebook, X, Truth Social, everywhere, at Grumblings Media. Until then, for my co-host, Mike Termott, this is Big John. We'll catch you next episode. Peace, everyone.